Morning. We have two cases scheduled for argument this morning, and we understand counsel in both cases announced ready and declared the time that you wish to take for your arguments. That being the case, we'll call Purdue, Brackett, Flores, and Burns versus Linebarger, Kogan, Blair, Sampson, and Meeks. Mr. Tammett.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, to try to put in perspective the quasi-judicial defense of appellees, I'm going to pose the Court a hypothetical situation about the judicial function, about a court at the highest level, about this court. It would be an outrageous example, or it's not an example, it's an illustration, but bear with me, and this could put it in perspective. Suppose this court is about to go into conference, and is in conference, and before it to decide is one of the hottest cases you've had in a few years. And just as the conference is assembling, down the hall, this couldn't happen, but suppose it does, comes no other than Brian Epstein. And he approaches the clerk, again, I'm making these facts up for illustration purposes only, approaches the clerk and says, here's a brief. I'd like for you to give it to the court, consider it in conference. And suppose, and it wouldn't happen, but suppose the clerk does it. And suppose the brief is from one of the lawyers in the case that the court has under consideration. And suppose even further, this is outrageous, but I've got to suppose it. Suppose that the clerk hands the brief to the court, and the court, in conference, considers it, and then suppose it holds in favor of the lawyer for whom Mr. Epstein is a political consultant. I pose you this question. In doing so, would the court be exercising its judicial function? Would the court, in considering something ex parte, outside all the rules, be acting in its judicial capacity in doing so? Now, if they're to be consistent, I think Frank Gilstrap will get up here and say, yes, that whenever a judicial body has judicial power, judicial function, well, whatever it does, it's acting in that capacity. We say the answer is no. You would not be exercising your judicial function because it would be outside all of the established rules and procedures for properly presenting a case to this court.
Now, so, counsel, though, you're saying that assuming that we took the brief into consideration, read it, deliberated on the case, that because I'm not following you. I mean, that seems to me to be at the core of what judicial function is all about.
But not, Your Honor, receiving one ex parte outside the rules from a delivered by a political consultant. Past the deadline, you know, no motion or anything to file the brief. It's the kind of brief that the court, I forgot to say this, you know, they didn't even ask for a motion for leave to file late. Totally improper. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine this court doing that or any other court of appeal.
Well, I mean, the court, you know, grants leave liberally to consider motions that are often filed outside of, you know, the regular time limit.
I'm an example of that myself, but I would never have the courage to come up before as the court was going into conference. Say, here's one now. Consider it. No brief. No certificate of conference. Anything at all. It's totally ex parte brief.
Well, let me turn that hypothetical around on you, counsel.
Ask you,
if it were not Brian Epstein who hand delivered the brief that the court considered, and it were just a lawyer for one of the parties in the case, would that change what you believe the result would be?
I think the same result from my viewpoint, that the court would not be exercising its proper judicial function, but not as extreme, not as extreme. You know, why would the lawyers before a case before the court, if they wanted a brief delivered, not deliver it themselves instead of having their political consultant do it? But that is the fact that occurred in this case before the Fort Worth City Council on December 7th, 2004. The City Council was about to go into closed session. Closed session is defined under the Texas Open Meetings Act as a meeting to which the public does not have access. So my clients were outside the hall. They did not attend the meeting, but here comes Brian Epstein, and he gives a 14-page memo to the city manager and says, you know, show this to the council and ask them to consider it. Now, what they were considering that brief, that memo in connection with, was an important item on the agenda as to whether or not the city council would follow the recommendation of the city manager and the city attorney to exercise the city's option to renew or to extend for another year the delinquent tax collection contract with the appellant's Purdue Brackett joint venture. There had already been a procedure for people to express their opposition to that. Mr. Epstein had sent memos to the city staff. This first went to the city staff. They had given criticisms, but the city staff rejected those, wrote a very favorable report about the joint venture's performance under its tax collection contract, and recommended to the city manager and the city attorney that the contract be extended. So that was the procedure. Those were the legal procedures that properly set up to do this. But here comes Mr. Epstein, not Linebarger, not one of the attorneys for the Linebarger firm, but a memo addressed to Mr. Boswell, showing carbon copy to Jim Lane, but asking him to consider this.
But if Mr. Epstein is agent of the Linebarger law firm,
yes,
which you do agree that that's he's serving as the...
Oh, yes, yeah, very definitely. That's
what difference does it make if Mr. Epstein is a political consultant or a runner or, I mean, what relevance does that have in the context of the legal issue that we're
having? All right. It's relevant in this aspect as to what the court asked a moment ago. Does it make a difference if the lawyer, as far as our viewpoint, that it would be outside the proper judicial function for a lawyer to come in out of the clear blue late before a conference and present a brief? Even more so with a political consultant. The question that I would have on this is why didn't the Linebarger firm do it itself? You know, they knew the staff, they were addressing it. It's not outrageous to assume that if people in city council are serving 2-year terms don't act favorably on a memorandum presented to them by a prominent political consultant like this, well, they might have an opponent at the next election. It might give some incentive to believe it.
But if the statements in the memo that Mr. Epstein delivered on behalf of the Linebarger firm were true, there would be no problem.
Well, there would be a problem in that the Linebarger firm and Mr. Epstein would have to prove those as true in court.
Mm-hmm.
But under the ruling by the court below, accepting the arguments of appellees, simply because the city council has the authority to investigate and decide, you know, similar to the authority to decide legal questions coming before this court on appeal, simply because they have that authority, then whatever they do in receiving a communication, that communication is absolutely privileged. And we say that that is not true and accurate for two reasons, basically. One, the city council, the court of appeals, anybody else is not only have to have the authority to investigate and decide. That's the definition of quasi-judicial for these purposes. We accept that. I mean, that's fundamental. The question is, in doing what they did, were they exercising those powers according to established rules and procedures that are accepted for presenting a complaint or a dispute to the quasi-judicial governmental authority to decide?
So, counsel, you think we got it wrong in Five Star? Is that what you're suggesting?
Your Honor, somehow I thought that might come up. Your Honor, and yes, and not wrong in this sense, because that was a different case in which strangely enough, the governmental employees who had been doing their duty for the FAA then were complained about by the guys who operated that helicopter service, and they complained. Now, where we feel the court went too far, and it didn't need to in that case, is saying that basically that if the governmental authority has or possesses quasi-judicial authority, then basically that's the end of the inquiry. Whatever is said to it is absolutely privileged. The court did not need to go that far, and even the cases that it cites in support of that shore that up. For example, if I could just discuss just a couple of them, that McAfee versus Feller, this court and the appellees say, well, the communication was privileged because it was made to a grievance committee to conduct investigations and make findings. They say no investigation took place. But later in that McAfee case, that's McAfee versus Feller, 452 Southwest 2nd, 56 at 58, what the court gave the reason for finding that privilege and said this: in this case, appellee followed substantially the legally designated procedures through the proper authorities to present the complaint, and therefore it is absolutely privileged. Not so in this case. Mr. Epstein, in delivering that to a closed session to which the public was not supposed to have any access, violated those principles. The court also cites the Rose versus First American Title Company, and it held there that the mere filing of a complaint with the Texas Board of Public Accountancy was privileged. But there the court also, after a few sentences after ruling that way, said this: First American used a lawful method to communicate its grievance. So in that kind of situation, this is where the distinction must be made, that the court below, and I wish to submit appellees are not making, that just because the authority has power to do something doesn't mean it can do it outside the established legal rules. Now, second, and I see time's running short, we ask the court again in our brief to consider what in the Sam Hill has ever happened to Hobart, on Hobart versus Gulf Atlantic Life Insurance, where the Supreme Court held that there was only a qualified privilege, not an absolute privilege, resulting from an investigation of the plaintiffs because of a suit that they well, leading up to a suit that they later filed for fraud and business disparagement, arising from a dispute with Gulf Atlantic over a life insurance over a health insurance project. The Supreme Court there quotes the restatement about what a privilege is confidential. The appellees say, well, there was no investigation. To the contrary, there was. The plaintiffs, the insurance brokers, the plaintiffs had their license revoked. Their agency that was put, that for which they formed to provide this business, was put into receivership. Thank you, the court.
Mr. Hammond, Ms. Gardner, do you have a question?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Mr. Gilstrap.
Ed, please, the court. Whatever happened to Hurlbut is that the case is not applicable. In Hurlbut, the involved reports to a law enforcement agency. There's there's two cases there, Hurlbut and Zarate, I believe. And in both cases, the report was made to an entity that had the power to investigate, but not the power to decide. That's how the Fifth Circuit distinguished those cases in the Shanks opinion, which is an excellent treatment of this entire area. If they don't have the power to decide, they don't have quasi-judicial power, hence no quasi-judicial privilege attaches to the communication. Counsel has conceded that the Fort Worth City Council has the power to investigate and decide. Therefore, it has the power, it has quasi-judicial power. Therefore, communications to the Fort Worth City Council about something which it either has the power to decide or is about to decide in this case are covered by the quasi-judicial privilege. Counsel here at the 11th hour has added a slight refinement to his argument, and I'm not criticizing him for that. That's how the appellate process works. You know, as the dish is cooked, it gets better. But the latest one is this. He says that the question depends on whether or not the determination of whether there is quasi-judicial privilege depends on whether the communication somehow is in accordance with some procedure. It's whether it's lawful. And he has this, what he calls an outrageous example of an attorney giving this court a letter brief at the 11th hour without seeking leave. Well, there's actually nothing wrong with that, of course. The court probably gets those all the time, and it can either read them or reject them. As long as you give a copy to the other side, there's no problem with that. Let me give you a more extreme example. Let's suppose that a litigant, the night before a trial, telephones a judge or a juror and discusses a case with them. Certainly, that's improper. You can probably go to jail for it. But no one suggests that that communication, if it's defamatory, is not covered by the quasi-judicial privilege. That's the issue that we have here. In this case, there wasn't anything wrong with Mr. Epstein's 11th hour communication to the city council. He didn't go into the closed session. He simply handed the memo to a council person before the session. You can do that. The fact that he's not a lawyer is fine. Citizens can communicate with the city council. There's nothing wrong with what he did. But even if it were, there were something wrong with it, the quasi-judicial privilege would still apply.
So any communication to a government entity that has authority, any communication whatsoever coming from any source, solicited or unsolicited, you say is covered by quasi-judicial immunity?
I think there may be a limit if depending on the subject matter. Some of the courts seem to talk about this. It's got to be within the subject matter of what council has the power to decide, and you can imagine a situation in which they're talking about road and bridges, and somebody stands up in front of the city council and starts talking about some of the criminal activity of one of the of some other person. I think that even happened in that case that that we talk about in connection with Norr Pennington out of East Texas, where they simply got up and talked about something completely outside the ambit of what was before the council. But aside from that limitation, I believe so. I mean, if they have, as the court said it in five state helicopters, if they have the authority to decide it, then it's covered by the privilege. It's not a question of whether or not the procedure is underway or it is being decided. You know, that sounds good, but it would be an impossible standard to apply. How far do you have to go before the privilege is triggered? Now, yes, if the statement is lawful, the court's going to remark that fact in reaching its in writing its opinion. If the statement if there's an investigation, the court is going to remark that in writing its opinion. If the investigation is fair, the court's going to remark that in writing its opinion. But no court has ever said, well, the investigation was not fair, therefore no quasi-judicial privilege. No court has ever said, there's no investigation, therefore no quasi-judicial privilege. And no court has ever said, well, the communication wasn't properly in accordance with our procedures, therefore no quasi-judicial privilege. The courts have made a policy choice. It's set forth in the five-state helicopters case. We want to encourage boards and commissions to have all facts before them. In return for that, we're willing to tolerate the fact that people will get up and make false statements, that they'll make them maliciously, and that they will make them in support of their own private interest. As Justice Scalia said in the Omni case, that's what petitioning the government is all about, your own private interest.
So what remedy does that leave for a party that's in the shoes of the appellant in this case that is allegedly slandered and is harmed in some way by that through this process? I'm thinking of the analogy of the court system. If a party misrepresents facts to a court, then there are certain sanctions that the court could issue. If the court finds out before it renders its decision, then it might affect the court's decision and so forth. But in a situation like this, it seems that there's no recourse for that party who's been harmed.
Well, there's certainly no recourse under the law of defamation. And that's as far as we're going here. There may be other recourse. Certainly in some of the examples you posed, Justice Casey, I mean, a person can be indicted for perjury. Lawyers who engage in ex parte communication can be disbarred.
Is that a consideration? I mean, I raised it, but I'm wondering, is that even a consideration in determination whether there's immunity or not?
It can't be a consideration in terms of whether or not there's quasi-judicial immunity. It's like I pointed out, I mean, If the process is fair and in accordance with the law, the courts are going to remark that and saying, you know, we're reaching a just result. But nobody has ever gone the other way. Nobody's ever said, whoops, there's something wrong with this communication that somehow destroys the immunity. No court has ever done that. And this court in five-state helicopter said that if the body has the authority, if it has quasi-judicial authority, then the quasi-judicial privilege applies. Now, let me add one thing further. In this case, this is one of those cases in which you could remark in writing your opinion, yes, there was an investigation, and yes, the investigation was fair. I mean, this communication was part of about a six-month-long process involving the cities deciding who gets the contract. It had begun the previous October when the city said, okay, the contract's about to end, we're going to start interviewing people. That's when the whole Betsy Price incident, you know, began during that period. Then we get to the decision whether or not they're going to renew the contract. Well, that's when the Epstein memo comes in. The city council doesn't take the business away from Purdue. They say, wait a minute, we're going to have an audit. They have a three-month audit in which the auditor very scrupulously sits down and talks to the joint venture and says, you know, what's your position? And that's all through the audit, auditee's response. Then at the end of the day, he says that the joint venture has messed up, that they owe the city money, and the city council at that point says, no, we're not going to pull the business. We're going to have another request for proposal procedure. We go through that. Both sides make presentations at a final hearing on May 17th of 05. Surely that's covered by the quasi-judicial privilege, although they've sued us for those statements too. And only after that does the city say, okay, we're going to award the contract to Linebarger. Now, there's nothing wrong with that procedure. Everything was properly done. That's how municipal government operates. And the notion that somehow you're going to say, oops, gosh, we found something wrong here and we're going to take the privilege away seems to me to have real slippery slope problems. And I don't think that they have given you the reason to go there. You've got to bear in mind the policy. The policy is we want full, open government with all the information and all the warts and all the problems that come from that. That's what we want. In answer to your question, Justice Casey, they may have a remedy, but the remedy can't be to hold the citizen liable for the statement that he makes to the city council. That would erode the privilege, and that decision's been made, and I don't think they've taken the case out from under that. Now,
would it make any difference if the communication was not made public or was not shared with the party against whom it was directed?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a statement in the brief from Prosser and Keaton that says it applies even to ex parte communications. I mean, it applies to all communications. It is an absolute privilege, and absolute means absolute. Now, if you're thinking, and let me say this, I think once you work through it, this case does not really wind up as a very important case. I mean, it's got important people, and part it's important to the litigants, and politicians are involved, and newspaper stories have been written. But at the end of the day, this case doesn't have any more judicial importance than Boris against Osborne, the case involving the two doctors. The one doctor treated an injured worker. The reviewing doctor from the insurance company wrote a letter that defamed him and sent it to the workers' comp carrier. And this court, in a per curiam memorandum opinion, said quasi-judicial privilege because it's preliminary to a possible workers' comp case. There's no evidence that there was ever a workers' comp case or a workers' comp investigation. There's no evidence in Reagan against Guardian Life Insurance Company that there was ever anything that happened as a result of the letter. But the courts, I suggest, cannot get into the position of saying, okay, citizen, you wrote the letter. Maybe you're covered, maybe you're not. Depends on whether they do something with it. That would be an intolerable result, and that's where they want you to go. I will, insofar as our alternate argument, which involves Norr Pennington, which obviously you don't have to go to unless you reverse the court below, then you have to reach that. I will only say that it is a real thicket of the law because we've got contradictory United States Supreme Court opinions on this. The on the one hand are the Norr Pennington case, on the other hand is McDonnell against Smith. I will only say that the answer to that has to do with part three of our argument, which involves the fact that they didn't raise it in their summary judgment response. They did not give you a reason, the reason that they now urge, which is, whoops, wrong privilege. We're arguing absolute privilege. They're arguing, all of a sudden, qualified privilege. They've got to tell the court below that they're arguing qualified privilege. They can't keep that hidden in their back pocket till they get to the Court of Appeals. That's lying behind the log. It doesn't necessarily involve burden of proof. We've got several instances in our rejoinder brief in which we point out plenty of instances involving usually limitations in which they say, whoops, wrong limitations. Too late. You've got to tell the court below that they're relying on the that you're relying on a different limitation statute. Similarly, in this case, they had to tell the court below that they're relying on a different privilege. They did not, and they waived that issue. And if there are no further questions, I'll be glad to conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gilstrap. Mr. Hammett?
Concerning the waiver issue, we had submitted a brief, one letter, one and a half page a brief on that, citing the Denton case. I must confess I'm still having trouble understanding why Frank is continuing to repeat this. They filed a motion for summary judgment alleging absolute privilege as a defense. Now, that's all. They did not allege in the alternative qualified privilege. We had no duty or obligation to raise the qualified privilege matter to try to rebut that at all. And we've cited cases both in our reply brief and in the one we request to leave for the court to consider, again, where they had to plead. They had to raise it. If they had raised qualified privilege, then we would have had to. Now, second, concerning the qualified privilege in Hurlbut, I urge the court to go read that case, the earliest part there. Mr. Gilstrap keeps saying, well, there was no investigation. Nothing was done about that. There was an investigation. The assistant attorney general to whom some of the complaints were made caused things to happen. And as I mentioned before, it's very plain in the opinion. The plaintiff's licenses were revoked. Their company was put into receivership. They were also later arrested, and although I don't think they were criminally convicted. That was done in the course of how the proper procedures work, and the Supreme Court held that the privilege was only conditional, not absolute. And this is in line with what should be resurrected, you know, in the Texas Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, that we cited in our reply brief. Every person shall be at liberty to speak, write, and publish his opinions on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that privilege.
But, counsel, I mean, we're talking about an entirely different entity in Hurlbut as we were dealing with in Five State, and isn't that the critical distinction, that in Hurlbut the law enforcement officers do not have the authority to investigate and decide in the sense that we were just talking about in Five State?
I think, well, in Five State, of course, and again, it's a different case because also in Hurlbut, you know, the assistant attorney general was not the plaintiff in a defamation suit. Like the if the, you know, the conscientious FAA employees in Five State, but it's the procedure of going, and we're talking about what is it, quasi judicial or is it not? That was quasi judicial, but the court clearly held that in Hulbert, but the privilege was only conditional.
Of course, the Supreme Court denied a petition for review in Five State, did it not?
Yes, it did.
I'm not supposed to read too much into that, but that would...
Well, certainly, and I think, and again, there, you know, that case is so much different because of who the plaintiffs were. I mean, that's a very unusual case where the government employees, investigators doing their job themselves become plaintiffs against some outsiders, you know, some third party over whom they had a regulatory responsibility. Frank mentioned McDonald versus Smith. That's emphasized in pages 6, 7, and 8 of our reply brief. May I just conclude with that, if there are any questions, where the Supreme Court, the United States, says the right to petition is guaranteed, the right to commit libel with impunity is not. So we respectfully ask the court to look at Hobart again and to find in this case that there is only a conditional privilege. For no questions, that's all I have to say, and I thank the court for its courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Hammett. Appreciate you and Mr. Gilstrap and also Mr. Bullard appearing here this morning to present your arguments. That they were well done, and the briefs were, of course, well done as well and very helpful to the panel. The case is submitted. We're going to recess for a panel substitution, and y'all are dismissed. Thank you.